Good evening, everyone. How wonderful to see you. How are you doing? How is life in your hut? What have you noticed inside and outside of your hut these days? The noticing is not so different, is it, inside and outside? All kinds of weather passing through. All kinds of events, inner and outer. But the noticing is very, very similar. What have you been hearing, seeing, smelling, touching in your permeable skin bag? What was inside? What was outside? One thing about living in a little ramshackle hut, like Ryokan, our friend Ryokan from last night, is that it's much more permeable than the concrete towers that so many people live and work in, many of which don't even have windows that open, right? Those horrible sealed buildings. And those poems of Ryokan give us that sense of inside and outside interpenetrating. Not many of us today live in little ramshackle huts, so we have to go outdoors to wake up to the life outside our walls. So I hope you've had a chance to do some of that. Tonight we're going to talk about another hermit who spent a lot of time outdoors. We've been time traveling in our visits to the hermits of ancient China and Japan. But this evening we're gonna travel across the Pacific Ocean and across the North American continent to visit that quintessential American hermit, hut dweller, Henry David Thoreau. Ryokan's and Thoreau's lifespans only differed, or they overlapped. They overlapped by about 14 years. But Ryokan lived in pre-modern Japan, where life was much as it had been for several hundred years before, or even longer, where most of his pilgrimage treks were on foot. But Thoreau's times were changing. He listened to steam trains passing along the tracks bordering Walden Pond. But the internal combustion engine was yet to come, and so much more. Ryokan had the venerable tradition of Chinese and Japanese hermits behind him, but Thoreau seems to have struck out on his own when he built his one-room cabin on Walden Pond near Concord, Massachusetts in 1845. I was curious to see how his experiences would compare to that of the Zen ancestors. So I pulled out a copy of Walden from our bookshelves, and I realized I felt rather vague about whether I had actually even read Walden. It's the sort of book you feel as though you've read because you've heard it quoted so often. That famous passage that goes, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only at the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Or if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. Had I been influenced by Thoreau when I moved to a rundown farm on the Bay of Fundy when I was 19 to learn how to take care of my basic needs without, as I would have put it then, exploiting others or being exploited? Before I knew the expression ahimsa, non-harming, Thoreau's words would certainly have appealed to me then. And of course there was his stance on civil disobedience, articulated in the essay that was originally titled Resistance to Civil Government. All men recognize and realize, of course, that his language was heavily male-gendered. All men recognize the right of revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. And in an essay called Slavery in Massachusetts, he wrote, "I would remind my countrymen that they are to be men first and Americans only at a late and convenient hour. No matter how valuable law may be to protect your property, even to keep soul and body together, if it do not keep you and humanity together." Those writings influenced Gandhi and Martin Luther King and countless others who actualized the theory and practice of civil disobedience far beyond what Thoreau ever did. He spent his single night in jail for refusing to pay a poll tax that went to support the U.S. imperialist war on Mexico, which would have extended the reach of slavery. I thought if I went to Canada, I wouldn't have to pay taxes that supported the war in Vietnam. But was it Thoreau that planted that seed of resistance? I actually couldn't really remember. So I decided to read some Thoreau. Civil disobedience sounded very familiar, as though I had certainly read it before. But Walden, the more I read, the more I became convinced that I had never read it. The American novelist John Updike has said, "A century and a half after its publication, Walden has become such a totem of the back-to-nature, preservationist, anti-business, civil disobedience mindset, and Thoreau so vivid a protester, so perfect a crank and hermit saint, that the book risks being as revered and unread as the Bible." And like the Bible, Walden yields some disturbing content to the critical reader. Thoreau's opening chapter is called Economy, and it's an extended critique of the materialistic values of the society of his day. It's a praise of frugality, simplicity, and self-sufficiency. And those values are eloquently expressed. After lamenting that people do not build their houses, grow their own food, or make their own clothing, he says, "Where is this division of labor to end? And what object does it finally serve? No doubt another may also think for me. But it is not therefore desirable that he should do so to the exclusion of my thinking for myself." Don't you think he'd turn over in his grave if he saw us all tethered to our cell phones these days? It's really easy to appreciate his anti-materialism. But where I started to be uncomfortable was with his harsh judgments of his fellow human beings. He seemed to have so much scorn for them, so little compassion. He prides himself on how little money he spent to build his cabin by Walden Pond, which, by the way, was about the same size as Ryokan's and Kamo no Chome's huts, about 10 by 10 feet. He bought a rundown shack from an Irish railroad worker for its lumber value and then transported the materials to Walden Pond. I'm going to read you his account of the transaction. It was of small dimensions, with a peaked cottage roof and not much else to be seen, the dirt being raised 5 feet all around as if it were a compost heap. The roof was the soundest part, though a good deal warped and made brittle by the sun. Door sill there was none, but a perennial passage for the hens under the doorboard. Mrs. Collins came to the door and asked me to view it from the inside. The hens were driven in by my approach. It was dark and had a dirt floor for the most part, dark, dank, clammy, and aguish, only here a board and there a board, which would not bear removal. She lighted a lamp to show me the inside of the roof and walls, and also that the board floor extended under the bed, warning me not to step into the cellar, a sort of dust hole 2 feet deep. There was a stove, a bed, and a place to sit, an infant in the house where it was born, a silk parasol, gilt-framed looking glass, and a patent new coffee mill nailed to an oak sapling, all told. The bargain was soon concluded, for James had in the meanwhile returned. I was to pay $4.25 tonight, he to vacate at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, selling to nobody else meanwhile, I to take possession at 6. At 6, I passed him and his family on the road, one large bundle held there all, bed, coffee mill, looking glass, hens. One wonders if they had to sell their shack for cash to eat, and where they went next. There's an account also of a terrible shipwreck of immigrants fleeing famine and British brutality in Ireland, most of whom were on the deck celebrating their imminent arrival in America when their ship was struck by a storm and nearly all perished. Children were being placed in coffins with their mothers so that there would be enough coffins for all the dead. Thoreau went as a kind of sightseer. You know how people go to look at the ambulances, gather. And he looked at the wreckage and the carnage and remarked, "On the whole, it was not so impressive a scene as I might have expected. If I had found one body cast upon the beach in some lonely place, it would have affected me more. I sympathized rather with the winds and the waves, as if to toss and mangle these poor human bodies was the order of the day. If this was the law of nature, why waste any time in awe or pity?" Chilly words from one we think of as a humanitarian. As you read Thoreau, sometimes his opposition to slavery and injustice seems based more on principle than on compassion and respect for his fellow human beings. There's a whole chapter of Walden devoted to Thoreau's agricultural efforts in his bean field and his inclusion of his accounting records made me smile, recalling my own youthful effort selling organic vegetables, eggs, and cheese from our roadside stand. 50 cents for a dozen eggs, 75 cents for 3 pounds of beans, etc. No premium on organics in those days. And yet, although Thoreau's farming was haphazard and impractical, and even takes a kind of perverse pride in that, he has little sympathy or understanding, even a kind of disdain for the lives of the farmers, his neighbors, making their livelihood and supporting families. My own farming experience taught me how implicated and interconnected I was still in complex systems, social, political, ecological, beyond my immediate control. But Thoreau's experience doesn't seem to shake him out of his idealistic notions of self-sufficiency, good old American individualism. He doesn't seem to open to humility. As he sets out his noble goals in Walden, he says nothing about his background. Born into an educated, politically progressive family, Harvard educated, with his father's pencil manufacturing factory to fall back on, and which he did use to pay his debts after his Walden experiment, which only lasted 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days. Though he spent the whole next decade writing the book. After graduating from Harvard, he worked briefly as a teacher, but he quit after 2 weeks when he refused to use corporal punishment. Then he and his older brother John started an independent school where they experimented with what we would now call experiential education. They took nature walks and they went to visit local businesses. But this venture was cut short when John cut himself and died painfully of tetanus in his younger brother's arms. I've wondered, what was the genesis of Thoreau's way-seeking mind? Could it have been those experiences? Did he truly have the aspiration of a bodhisattva? When he went to the woods, what was he fleeing or seeking? And what brought him back into the village? Walden answers none of these questions satisfactorily. And it made me wonder if I read more of his journals, if they would be more revealing, more personally revealing. After his brother's death, Thoreau met the transcendentalist philosopher and writer Ralph Waldo Emerson, who took the young man under his wing, introduced him to his circle of progressive friends, and even took him into his home as his children's tutor, his own editorial assistant, and all-around handyman and gardener. The very land Thoreau built his cabin on, beside Walden Pond, was provided by Emerson. But Thoreau acknowledges none of this in Walden. He seems to pride himself on a self-sufficiency that he never really had or achieved. His tone is often kind of supercilious towards the ordinary folk, his neighbors in town and country, while seemingly blissfully unaware of his own glaring inconsistencies. Plenty of contemporary critics have called him out on his hypocrisy, while his defenders maintain worshipful adoration. Apparently, a few years ago, there was a media dust-up among commentators over Thoreau's laundry. Has anyone ever heard of this issue? Yeah. Various experts and commentators weighing in on the fact that he took his laundry home on his frequent visits to his family. Now, Thoreau taking his dirty laundry home to his mother makes an easy target and an easy trope. But consider, he was a man of his time. So it's not surprising that he didn't take his laundry down to the shore of the pond and pound it on stones. The writer Rebecca Solnit wrote an essay on this debate, and she contacted some Thoreau scholars for their opinions. And one of them wrote her back and said this. While Thoreau was at Walden, his family were in a house he helped build the year before he moved to the cabin, he and his father mainly, so he had considerable goodwill in the bank. During his entire adult life, he paid rent while at his parents' boarding house and paid it faithfully, with records sometimes kept on the backs of poems or other writings. He worked in the garden, helped keep the house in good repair, provided foods from his own garden and so on. People did drop by the cabin to bring him food sometimes, but people dropped by each other's houses with food all the time. It was the most common gift. Remember what I said yesterday about the gift giving and receiving culture in Ryokan's day in Japan? He brought other people food, especially melons. He was legendary for his talent in raising a vast array of melons. I don't know if I have an actual record of the family doing his laundry, but I'll check. But I would bet they did sometimes do his laundry. He was quite emotionally dependent upon his family, especially his mother. But he also contributed constantly. When his brother died young, Henry helped take up the slack in financial help. When his father died, Henry became not only the man of the house, but the major force in the pencil business. So I think what I'm trying to say is that even at Walden, he was very much a part of the family in every way. Not evident when you read the book. Another one of the scholars speculated that it was quite likely that the family employed household help to do the laundry, more than likely from the Irish immigrant population. This cliche of Thoreau having his mother or his sisters do his laundry does not do justice to the real lives of these women, who, along with Emerson's wife, were the driving forces of the Concord Female Anti-Slavery Society that, according to a scholar who studied them and wrote a book about them, they had a pronounced and far-reaching influence on the most noted anti-slavery speakers and writers of the day. So while Thoreau was walking in the woods and hoeing in his bean field, they were doing the work of helping slaves on the Underground Railroad. So I decided I really want to learn more about these women and track down this book, this study about them. And I think rather than condemning or defending Thoreau, it's important to find a middle ground from which to take a perspective that can hold the complexity of this gifted and difficult character. He was well educated in the Greek and Latin classics as well as English literature, and Walden is sprinkled with references, and he also read and appreciated the wisdom traditions of other cultures, writing this: "I do not prefer one religion or philosophy to another. I have no sympathy with the bigotry and ignorance which make transient and partial and puerile distinctions between one man's faith or form of faith and another's. To the philosopher, all sects, all nations are alike. I like Brahma, Hari, Buddha, the Great Spirit, as well as God. I lay down the book and go to my well for water, and lo, there I meet the servant of the Brahman, priest of Brahma and Vishnu and Indra, who still sits in his temple on the Ganges reading the Vedas, or dwells at the root of a tree with his crust and water jug. I meet his servant, come to draw water for his master, and our buckets, as it were, grate together in the same well." Thoreau would have had little access to Buddhist texts, for few were translated, and certainly there were no Zen texts yet available to him, and one can't help but wonder what they might have opened up to him. Of course, we're biased. His version of enlightenment seems to aim at moral improvement, primarily focused on moral improvement. He wrote, "Morning is when I am awake and there is a dawn in me. Moral reform is the effort to throw off sleep. Why is it that men give so poor an account of their day if they have not been slumbering? We must learn to reawaken and keep ourselves awake, not by mechanical aids, but by an infinite expectation of the dawn, which does not forsake us in our soundest sleep. I know of no more encouraging fact than the unquestionable ability of man to elevate his life by a conscious endeavor. It is something to be able to paint a particular picture or to carve a statue or so to make a few objects beautiful. But it is far more glorious to carve and paint the very atmosphere and medium through which we look, which morally we can do, to affect the quality of the day. That is the highest of arts. To affect the quality of the day, the art of living. Maybe this is the closest that Thoreau comes to a kind of bodhisattva vow. And yet, there seems no room in it for understanding and compassion for human folly and frailty. It's all about, achieving, transcending. Though Thoreau only spent such a short time in his iconic cabin at Walden, the elements of his life there continued to be part of his life. Work, reading, solitude, walking, noticing. He valued physical labor, that the embodied experience of it, and the satisfaction of building, making, growing, meeting his basic needs. But he had trouble integrating that into the wider society. He wrote in his journal, "What is the use in trying to live simply, raising what you eat, making what you wear, building what you inhabit, burning what you cut or dig, when those to whom you are allied insanely want and will have 1,000 other things which neither you nor they can raise and nobody else perchance will pay for?" So what is the use of trying to be self-sufficient and pure when everyone else is pursuing materialistic goals? He really struggled with that. But he also loved leisure, reading, purposeless contemplation. Most of all, he loved solitary walking and paying attention to the natural world. His writing about ideas and principles is often kind of pompous, heavy-handed, and kind of judgmental of others. But his writings about nature are beautiful and full of detailed observation. For him, the human world was problematic. But isn't that our challenge too? To see our fellow humans with the eyes of a bodhisattva? He writes, "I have never felt lonesome or in the least oppressed by a sense of solitude but once, and that was a few weeks after I came to the woods, when, for an hour, I doubted if the near neighborhood of man was not essential to a serene and healthy life. To be alone was something unpleasant, but I was at the same time conscious of a slight insanity in my mood and seemed to foresee my recovery." Has anyone felt a slight insanity in their mood and been able to foresee their recovery? "In the midst of a gentle rain, while these thoughts prevailed, I was suddenly sensible of such sweet and beneficent society in nature, in the very pattering of the drops, and in every sound and sight around my house, an infinite and unaccountable friendliness, all at once like an atmosphere sustaining me, as made the fancied advantages of human neighborhood insignificant, and I have never thought of them since." I think he's exaggerating. "But every little pine needle expanded and swelled with sympathy and befriended me. I was so distinctly made aware of the presence of something kindred to me, even in scenes which we are accustomed to call wild and dreary, and also that the nearest of blood to me and humanist was not a person or a villager, that I thought no place could ever be strange to me again." Such a moving and beautiful expression of belonging and connection with the natural world. But still, humans are left out. Here's a passage he wrote on listening and seeing. While we are confined to books, the most select and classic, and read only particular written languages, which are themselves but dialects and provincial, we are in danger of forgetting the language which all things and events speak without metaphor, which alone is copious and standard. Much is published, but little printed. The rays which stream through the shutter will no longer remembered when the shutter is wholly removed. No method or discipline can supersede the necessity of being forever on the alert. What is the course of history or philosophy or poetry, no matter how well selected, or the best society, or the most admirable routine of life, compared with the discipline of looking always at what is to be seen? So it seems Thoreau had found naturally, through his own experience and observation, this discipline of careful looking and listening. And the way he practiced this was most often on his long meandering walks, with pauses for contemplation and observing as he went along. He wrote, "If you are ready to leave father and mother and brother and sister and wife and child and friends and never see them again, if you have paid your debts and made your will and settled all your affairs, you are a free man, then you are ready for a walk." Now, this might sound like hyperbole, but maybe it's a kind of expression of Thoreau's sense of his walking practice as a home leaving, as a letting go of his worries. I think he worried about his family a lot, though he doesn't own up to it in Walden, maybe in his journals. Letting go of his worries, letting go of the responsibilities of his life, of his family and his community and his public persona, his self-preoccupation. Letting go of all that, opening his senses, and directly perceiving the nature of being. As he put it, alert to find the God in nature. Of course, Thoreau never read Dogen, but I think he would have recognized Dogen. What Dogen meant when he said to carry yourself forward and experience the 10,000 things is delusion, that the 10,000 things come forth and experience themselves as awakening. I think it's exactly what Thoreau was experiencing on his walks. In his day, there was not the light pollution that we're so accustomed to these days. And he writes about feeling his way home from the village in the dark on a moonless, cloudy night, or getting lost in the snowy woods. And I think his writing about that, it sort of extends to his sense of self, self in world, self in nature. He writes, "Every man has to learn the points of compass again as often as he awakes, whether from sleep or any abstraction. Not till we are lost, in other words, not till we have lost the world, do we begin to find ourselves and realize where we are and the infinite extent of our relations." We have to learn the points of a compass again. When we awake from our distraction, our delusion, we have to realign ourselves, right? And when we're lost from all our conditioning, we've lost the world as we know it, and we begin to find ourselves, and we realize the infinite extent of our relations. Maybe it was easier for Thoreau to write about the vastness of his relations in nature than with his family and his fellow human beings. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have the emotional awareness or vocabulary or the insight to do so. And yet his human bonds were strong. After Walden, he went back to live with the Emersons for a short time, and then he spent the rest of his days living with his family, never having married, involved with the family business and work, the anti-slavery movement. His older sister, Helen, died at the age of 36 of tuberculosis. Thoreau himself died at the age of 44, complications of tuberculosis, and his younger sister, Sophia, 14 years later, of the same disease, after having edited and published many of his writings. Can't help but wonder how his practice would have matured if he had reached the age of Ryokan or of Shuto, 70, 80, 90. To me, there's something poignant and mysterious about this human Thoreau, not the icon of Walden, the Walden Pond hermit, but the human Thoreau who is so devoted to and enmeshed with his family life, even in his time at the cabin. He never was the idealized hermit of Walden Pond, and yet he kept walking and observing and taking refuge in the vast holiness of the world his entire life. And maybe that brings him closer to us in our own yearnings, our own ambivalences, our own moments of retreat and refuge in the wild, and our struggles with the complexity of human relationships, human frailty, and the endless capacity for human self-delusion, self-deception. Maybe we can take heart from his quirky, stubborn courage. Maybe we can claim him as an ancestor in our gallery of hermits, even if he wasn't really a hermit. So thank you for paying a visit to Walden Pond with me this evening. Has anyone ever actually been there? I was only once, long, long, long ago. Yeah, so maybe this coming week, maybe we can really... Oh, wait. I said coming week as though we were doing this weekly. We're doing it daily. Nonetheless, maybe we can take forward this sense of including humanity in our hut, in our hearts, our own humanness as well as the vast sense of our boundless relations in the natural world. So thank you once again, everyone, for coming and practicing with us this evening. Let's chant.